committee, I'm going to move around on this, the agenda. I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 596. And Janet, can you brief us where we're at with that one?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 596 is the bill that was introduced at the request of Sheriff John Reichel from Clatsop County. He was at the meeting on Friday and explained the situation at the scene of an accident where a sheriff or a local law enforcement official or a state police official might have a need to move a vehicle off the highway, a disabled vehicle off the highway, by pushing it with a push bumper on the law enforcement vehicle. The bill also changed, this bill allows that to happen and states that the liability for the police officer doing that would be, they would be eliminated from civil liability under that case. It also made changes to the duties of the driver at the scene of an accident. There was some discussion and concern about that from the trucking industry, from AAA and law enforcement about those changes. What the Dash A3 amendments do is they delete any changes to the duties of the driver at the scene of an accident, so those would stay as they are under current law. So all that's remaining of the bill in the Dash A3 amendments is the law enforcement officer being able to either move the vehicle, push the vehicle aside, or direct the driver of the vehicle involved in the accident to move the vehicle. And stipulates that a person acting under this authority is not liable for damage to the vehicle if they are making reasonable efforts at removal. Legislative Council has informed us that these kinds of elimination of liability may or may not be totally effective if they were completely tested in court, but it would be a help to have it in here, and so that is the reason for the bill. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Jim. Representative Greenlee.
The original bill amends 811-700. This doesn't do that, is that right? 811-700 will stay just the way it is. This will be added in its proper place in the statute.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Janet.
Yes, that's the effect of the bill. There would be no changes to 811-700. Some of the concern about the changes to 811-700 was it seemed pretty open-ended, and it wouldn't let the driver of the vehicle know for sure what they were supposed to do.
Okay, is there anyone here to testify on to the A3 amendments?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. We support the amendments that the staff has just outlined.
Mr. Chairman, Larry Campbell, representing AAA and the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police. We support the amendments as submitted.
Thank you. Is there anyone else to testify on it? The chair would move the A3 amendments to Senate Bill 596. Is there any discussion? Ryan, will you call the roll, please? Pardon? Janet says, is there any objection?
All right.
None. Seeing that the amendments are adopted, the chair would move Senate Bill 596 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Hearing none, we'll land you a call and roll, please.
Representative Mabry.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Beyer.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Just say aye.
Aye.
Thumbs up.
Aye.
596.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion passes unanimous. Representative Greenlee moves the Senate Bill 596 to be placed upon the consent calendar. Is there any objection? Seeing none, it's on the consent calendar.
You got it.
Call the mouse.
Okay, now which one? Yep. We're going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 549. And Janet, can you get us up to speed, please?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 549 would increase the maximum payroll tax rate for mass transit districts by 0.1% of the wages paid for each employee. It would specify that the district, a district board may adopt an ordinance increasing the tax authority only if the economy in the district has recovered from the recent economic downturn as reflected in regional employment and income growth. It requires the payroll tax increase to be phased in over a 10-year period beginning on or after January 1st, 2004, and sunsets the 10-year phase-in period beginning on 2014. The limit on the annual payroll tax increase would be 0.02%, and it applies both to payroll and to the self-employment tax in the TriMet district. Mr. Chair, this bill was sponsored by the Committee on Revenue and was in the Senate Revenue in the Revenue Committee on the Senate side. And you have a Senate vote. You have at your place also the Senate staff measure summary, the fiscal impact statement, and the revenue impact statement, and you should be looking at the A engrossed version of the bill.
Thank you, Janet. Could I have Fred Hansen and Olivia Clark, please? And Lynn Lundquist, why don't you join them, too?
Good morning, Mr. Chairman.
Good morning. Members.
For the record, my name is Olivia Clark. I'm the Executive Director of Government Affairs for TriMet, and with me is our General Manager, Fred Hansen. Thank you very much for scheduling Senate Bill 549. We appreciate that, and we're here today to request your support for that bill. As you recall, we came before you one other time. I think that was back in February, where we gave you a general overview of TriMet, how TriMet works, how big it is, and how important TriMet is to the regional transportation system. I'd like to review just a couple of those points and then turn this over to Fred Hansen to talk a little bit more specifically about why we need this bill and why we need it now. Just to refresh your memory, TriMet was created back around 1969 when the Rose City Transit, I believe, went belly up, as they say. Right now, for the last 10 years, TriMet has experienced tremendous ridership growth, 5% per year, roughly, in the last 10 years, which is really remarkable. We're about 29th largest transit agency in the country, but we have the 13th highest ridership, which is very remarkable. We have about 88 million boards per year, which translates to roughly 300,000 rides a day. So it's a pretty remarkable system, particularly for this metropolitan area. When we were here in February, we also talked to you a little bit about TriMet's importance to the regional economy, and I just want to point out a couple of things to refresh your memory there, is that TriMet plays a very critical role in the metropolitan area as far as keeping the area in attainment with the Federal Clean Air Act. We make a real, very big impact there and actually create capacity for the expansion of high tech and the expansion of manufacturing firms. We also believe that we have a very large impact on congestion, particularly when it comes to Highway 26 and Highway 84, as well as some of our major arterials. We believe that we've played a very big share in increased development and investment along the light rail lines. In fact, there's been, we estimate, $3 billion worth of investment within walking distance of all the light rail transit stations. And we're also responsible for bringing in about $1 billion worth of federal investment in the transit area in the last 10 years, which is a big boom for our area, and we hope to do more. But the bill that's before you today would enable us to continue to meet that growth and also bring in those federal dollars. And I'd like to ask Fred Hansen to talk a little bit about why this bill, why now?
Morning, Fred.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, again, for the record, I'm Fred Hansen, the general manager of TriMet. One of the things that I wanted to be able to stress, and again, it's the why now, why the urgency. The federal government, when they allocate federal dollars in many of the places that we are familiar with, they are allocated by formula. That's based on population or various other things. One of the relatively rare exceptions to that is in the transit world, and that is that it is a large discretionary dollars that are made available and are competed for across the nation by different metropolitan areas, by different transit agencies. We have been very successful in that. As Olivia indicated, over the last 10 years, we brought in about $1 billion, $100 million per year on average, in federal discretionary dollars. One of the reasons why Senator Gordon Smith has been so strongly supportive of making these dollars available and spending his time on it is because, as he says, it's one of the few places that he is able to influence discretionary dollars to be coming back to Oregon because we are a donor in terms of income. The part that's important is that the federal transportation legislation, it's a 6-year bill. It's up before the Congress today for reauthorization during this congressional session. We'll see whether they are successful in making that happen. But what's so important about it is, as they authorize new projects around the country, they are looking at really three major issues to be able to be addressed, the so-called three-legged stool. One is that the project actually has the kind of ridership is expected to have the kind of ridership that means that the investment is worthwhile, that land use and various other things connect to it, the type of development patterns. On that count, the Portland region, Oregon in general, but the Portland region scores very high and will continue to score very high. Second is that there has to be a match for the actual construction of the project. The federal government puts in between 60 and generally about 60%, a little bit higher than that on the Interstate MAX project that's currently under construction. But they put in those federal dollars but expect to have local dollars. Those have been generated and will continue to be generated locally, and those issues are things that the Portland region is addressing. But the third, and why this piece of legislation is important, that third leg of the stool, is that they also don't want to build something that isn't going to be able to be operated. Consequently, they asked to be able to have assurances that there are 20 years' worth of sufficient operating revenues so that once the line has been built or the system has been built, that it will be able to operate. The bill, Senate Bill 549, allows that to be able to be addressed within the region to be able to assure that we have those operating revenues so that we can continue to get those very large discretionary allocations. Not for certain, but we believe we will have very good success. When we were here in February, we also addressed the very important issue of the Productivity Improvement Program. That's the video that we showed you. But it's one of the things that's very important. We would not be coming to the legislature to ask for authorization to be able to have the TriMet Board raise the payroll tax, but for the fact that we had looked internally and have now saved approximately $10 million per year by being able to do things smarter and more efficient. I think that's a real success. We have another $8 million we have identified over the next 3 years, and we believe that that's very important. Two last important elements about the legislation before you. Number one is the commitment that's made by us, by the board of directors, that George Pasador chairs, and that is that all revenues, any revenues that would be generated by this, will go only to new service, not to fill, which has been, I mean, we've had a very tough economic time, as everybody has, and we have been able to handle that by cutting budgets and by the productivity improvement process. But any dollar generated by Senate Bill 549 would be used only for new service. Secondly, the commitment of my board president, George Pasador, the whole board, and specified in the Senate amendments to Senate Bill 549 is that there would be no increase in the payroll tax, no beginning of that phase in until the economy has recovered sufficiently to warrant that. We believe that's very important. You have before you a list of all the broad-based, both business and other community support that is there for the legislation. We would urge your moving it on in the process. We thank you very much.
Thank you, Fred. Any questions? Representative Greenland.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. friend Olivia, I'm not sure which one can answer. I'm a very strong supporter of this bill, and I was a little worried about the amendments in the Senate that talks about the requirement that the board certify the economic problems of the district are over. I understand that phase, but you add that to the 10-year phase-in as well. Does that cause you any trouble? I mean, if you need to wait 3 years to do that, say, and then you have to phase it in over 10 years from that point, I assume this means. Is that correct?
Mr. Chairman, the answer is it does not cause us a difficulty. Obviously, all of us are expecting that the economy will come back sometime in the not-too-distant future, but nobody has been able to predict that exactly. What's important on that three-legged stool that I outlined is that we must assure that at the time a new light rail alignment opens, for example, or a major new bus expansion, that we will have at that point the ability to be able to operate. Because there is a longer lead time, we believe that this legislation will not in any way adversely affect our ability to be able to get those discretionary dollars.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Dingfelder.
Thank you. Thanks for coming today, Fred. And I also am very supportive. Obviously, I have a lot of constituents who utilize TriMet, and I have Highway 84 in my district, which is, as I've mentioned before, a parking lot for a good part of the day. Question, I just want to confirm, though, there has not been a rate increase since 1969. Is that correct as far as the cap, when the original inception of TriMet?
There are two elements to it, and I just want to be sure, Mr. Chairman, Representative Infelder, that I'm absolutely precise. The legislation that created TriMet established the 0.6% in the statute. That is slightly modified if there's an area that withdraws because of the nature of debt service requirements. That cap, the maximum, has not been changed since the original legislation. However, the original, in the early 70s, it was not at the full cap. Late 70s was when the TriMet board last raised it to the maximum cap, and it has been at that maximum cap level since the late 70s.
Okay, thank you for that clarification.
Is there any other questions? Thank you. Lynn, you'd like to go ahead, please?
For the record, I'm Lynn Lundquist, president of the Oregon Business Association, and we're here today to support the passage of this bill and move it in the process, and very concerned that it works its way completely through the process. Oregon Business Association, as you all, most of you I'm sure realize, is a statewide organization that functions primarily in three major areas. That's transportation, education, and a sustainable economy and environment together. And so since transportation is one of our three major planks, obviously we should play a role here. I will tell you that we typically do not participate in those activities or functions that are not statewide. And so someone might ask, well, TriMet is not statewide. Yet we, if you will, bend our rigid, if you will, I guess, outline in those situations where we believe it has a significant impact on the state as a whole. For example, on OHSU and the tram, we got involved in that. We think that TriMet has a significant impact on the economy of the state and on the business climate of the state, even though it is not just continually statewide, geographically statewide. I think the importance, I hope that the committee would see the importance of OBA testifying here today, is the fact that we're the ones who pay the bill. We, being the business community, we don't represent obviously all of the business community in those areas, but we certainly represent a significant portion of that. So when the business community steps up and says we're willing to increase the tax on our payroll for this, the question is why? And I think I'll do that very precisely. First of all, the Clean Air Act is a major impact on the business community. We understand that if the Clean Air Act is not met, that the business community can come in to help meet that in a way that is detrimental to our business enterprises. And so we're very concerned that TriMet helps the region meet its clean air goals. Secondly, we're looking at new services. We're expanding. Obviously, we're in a recession now, but the area will expand. And we, by the way, had TriMet before our committees twice. We sort of grilled them. to make sure before we went out and said that we would support this particular bill. So we are very concerned. We are very supportive of the fact that these are for new services, and obviously, as Representative Greenlick mentioned here in regard to the fact of when it's implemented, that's also important to us. And we see those are as major reasons why the business community is willing to step up and say, yes, we will support an increase in our payroll tax because we think the benefits exceed the costs that are involved. And I guess just lastly, I'll leave it at this, and that is that George Pasador, who's chairman of the board, is a gentleman who obviously is chairman of Wells Fargo, understands sound business principles. And we can all talk about, that's just one person, but it does impact. We all base things based upon the people who are running the show. And we have a great deal of confidence in George that we'll make those good business decisions, and Fred, obviously, as manager as well. Thank you for the opportunity, and we are very supportive and hope that it moves its way completely through the process.
Thank you, Lynn. Any questions?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, Restaurant Association opposed it. Do they still oppose this bill, or can you give us some feedback on that?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman, Representative Honor, I don't have the answer to that. I just don't have the answer to that. And they may still oppose the bill. But our association has a broader base. We have some restaurants. That only is a small part of the total.
And a follow-up. On the 10-year phase-in, so the economy starts going good and we phase it in, what happens if after 2 years we have a big slump? Does it phase out or is it still going to sit there?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Zahner, the authority exists for the TriMet Board to be able to, by ordinance, make any alteration in that. Their commitment is to be able to do it in a way that makes best economic sense for the region. So they have the ability to be able to begin the phase in and then to be able to stop it if they so chose.
Representative Mabry.
Well, just make sure I understand, and I think I do, but you can clarify for me. It was originally established at 0.6%. What we're being asked to do is increase that allowable amount by 1%, which would make it 0.7%.
By 0.1%.
By 0.1%. And all we're being asked to do is increase that permissive amount, not increase the tax itself, which would, if it were to be increased, the TriMet Board would have to make that transaction, that decision in public meeting, and deal with the political ramifications, the yeas and nays of that. And thirdly, if the TriMet Board took that action and there were sufficient opposition, it is referable to the voters by referendum.
Mr. Chair, Mr. Vice Chair, the answer is absolutely. The action by the by the legislature is merely to authorize, really to give a local option to the TriMet Board to be able to allow that to be raised. They must do it by ordinance, and that ordinance is referable either on their own initiative or by petition.
So follow up then, an action of the Oregon legislature would be showing a trust of local government working.
Yes.
I have one other question, Mr. Chair. Thank you. On the Senate vote, 20-7, were those seven that were against it, were they from Metro or were they from rural senators, or do you know?
I'm not recalling any from the metropolitan area that were no...
Oh, okay.
Senator Minnis was a no vote. The others were spread, but on the support side, it was a broad bipartisan rural and urban level of support.
I got it here. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Chair? And Chair, thank you for...
that was Janet. So. Mm-hmm. Any other questions? And thank you for your testimony.
Thank you for your time.
Mm-hmm. Could I have Mike Solgiver and Linda Lynch?
Pardon me?
It doesn't look like they
show up. I can't.
Yeah.
Thank you. Good morning, Mr. Chairman. I'm Linda Lynch, and I'm the Government Relations Manager for Lane Transit District. And I want to be, I want everyone to be clear that the bill applies also to Lane Transit District, which is governed by the same statute that created TriMet. And our story is a lot like TriMet's in the sense of what we're trying to accomplish over the next 10, 20 years. I've given you a packet that includes a letter from the General Manager, Ken Ham, and it also includes support from the business community, the Chambers of Commerce of both Eugene and Springfield, and there's a letter from one of the major employers in the region, Peace Health. I could also provide letters from restaurants and smaller businesses, but I just didn't build you a bigger pack. I believe that LTD, Lane Transit District, has a broad base of support in the community for a couple of reasons. The first is that LTD is really seen as a partner in community events. And our surveys actually show that over 60% of people in Eugene and Springfield say that they have used LTD, that they've ridden the bus, and that's a very high number. I think that number is probably attributable to University of Oregon sports events where 8 days a year or 6 days a year, we prevent gridlock and deliver a sizable portion of people to Autzen Stadium and have allowed the university to expand the stadium without having to increase parking. The other reason is that we offer the promise of federal investment in an aggressive capital campaign to build a bus rapid transit system in Eugene and Springfield. I think that people understand that it requires local match, federal funds require local match, and that they're prepared to step up and help. And I think that the chamber endorsement letters definitely reflect their support for that capital investment in an improved, more reliable transit system. And I can answer any other questions.
Thank you, Linda. Is there any questions, Linda? Don't see any. We'll go ahead with you, Mike, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Mike Salzgiver with the Portland Business Alliance. We're here to support this bill. And let me tell you a little bit about the alliance and our mission and why we are here today. First of all, our mission is to enhance the business climate in the Portland metropolitan area. We think this bill does that in a number of ways. First of all, when you look at the long-term economic health of our region, transit is an important part of that. And this bill, when you look at TriMet's financial picture going out over the next decade plus, they are going to need to continue to grow their operational budget so that they can provide add service and provide the level of transit service to the metropolitan area that our that people in the region have come to expect. The process that the alliance went through to review this bill was, as Mr. Lundquist's organization, very similar. We held three separate hearings. I think Fred began to think he was at least a part of our staff, if not a member of our board. But we brought the TriMet before our transportation committee, before our full policy committee, and then before our board to explain the bill, talk about why it was necessary, and answer any questions that the board had. We were worked with TriMet to include the language that triggers the authority to increase it on the basis of a determination that the economy recovered that was important to a number of our members. And as a result of our general view of the importance of ongoing healthy transit system in the Portland metropolitan area, the history that TriMet has in working collaboratively and positively with the business community, and given the adjustments that were made in the original bill, our board voted 23-2 to support this this measure. We think it's important for the long-term positive business climate and growth of our region, and we would encourage this committee to vote it forward and do everything you can to see it enacted into law. Thank you.
Representative Ryan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I should have mentioned, asked this before. I was actually at the Springfield Chamber legislative meeting where they did take this issue on and discuss it, and they were very supportive. But for some reason, I must have a separate file that I've been putting everything from LTD in, and it's not in this file. And I know that LTD has raised and lowered their rate, and I'm over the years, and I'm not sure where they are now. Can you? Are you at the cap?
Yes, we are at the cap, and we've been at the cap since 1994. Over time, LTD, I think in response to questions that you had earlier about whether or not we could roll or adjust the rate should the economic conditions not continue to improve, LTD is, that's really been consistent with LTD board practice, which is to reflect the community. So when the economy took a big dive in the early 80s, especially in Lane County, it would. The board also rolled back the rate of the payroll tax. So, and I have to have a chart that I've given to Terry that shows different rates over different times. So, which I'd be glad to provide to the committee. Thank you.
Any other questions?
Yeah. So you're at the top of the cap now during these tough economic times. Shouldn't it be going down?
Well, the payroll tax, I think that we have the support from the business community to stay at this level, because as you can see that they've endorsed it going to 0.7%. Also because it's been since that time that we've embarked on a capital campaign to build a bus rapid transit system that the business community really has seen as vital to future business development in the area. And we've partnered with major employers like Peace Health in planning for this improved transit system to operate much like rail, and it would serve major employers directly.
One follow-up. Has the cap ever gone down? And when it did,
well, the cap has remained the same in statute since 1969.
But you've gone down.
Yes.
Yeah, so the level of payroll charge just went down from the cap.
And it's been a local decision, right?
Right. Is there any questions of Mike? Thank you, folks, for your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Going to have John Charles, please. Good morning, John.
Good morning. Thank you for the opportunity. My name is John Charles. I'm an analyst with Cascade Policy Institute, a free market think tank in Portland. Our comments this morning are focusing really only on the effect of this on TriMet. I have no particular knowledge of the Lane County Transit District. As a regular TriMet user, I have a vested interest in good transit service, but that does not necessarily follow that you should increase the payroll tax rate, and our view is that there are a number of other things that could be done first before you increase the rate. And I have spent the last 3 or 4 months looking into this in particular because of an incident that happened in 1994 when TriMet negotiated a major contract with the union, and Lauren Weiss, the TriMet board chair, who was very opposed to that deal that was negotiated behind closed doors, was actually essentially ousted by Governor Roberts. And he wrote a letter to the editor in 1994, and I've quoted from it here, predicting that all of these high labor costs that were negotiated would doom TriMet. And my interest in the last 3 months in researching is, well, was Lauren Weiss correct? And in my research, I think that he was rather prescient. He saw that this was going to cause TriMet eventually to come to you and ask for more money. As he said, if there's one predictable reason for transit to fail its mission, it is the burden of fixed costs, which this contract guarantees. Now, in particular, it's the rising cost of pensions and fringe benefits. And I spent a lot of time going through audited financial statements for the last almost two decades, and I display the data there. And I think what you see there is by six different measures, nothing but rising costs. Especially for pensions, especially for the unfunded pension liability, which I'm sure is a rather sore subject around here. And while I give TriMet board and management credit for just a few months ago, well, just in April, changing so that all new hires are put into a defined contribution plan, which is all optional for existing folks, in most respects, to me, it seems too little and too late. I'm not a pension fund expert, but I think you might want to ask some questions here about the extent to which benefits, fringe benefits in the current budget are about 65% of the cost of salaries. Fringe benefits seems to be cannibalizing the general fund budget, and that strikes me as a very serious problem, a problem that TriMet could have controlled any time in the last 15 years, and they quite consciously chose not to. Now, it's interesting, if you look at TriMet's labor costs in-house versus out-of-house, there have been a number of examples. The Sunnyside shuttle on the east side in the mid-90s, or most recently the Cedar Mill shuttle, in which they did contract out, in this case to Sassy Cab, for a shuttle in the Cedar Mill. And because of their strict labor rules, they had to bring it back in-house in September of 2002. And as soon as they brought it back in-house, their expenses immediately went up by 18%, and they cut the service 50%. The contracted out service was $24 per driver hour, and the unionized in-house service is $49 per driver hour. Now, I have no problem with employees trying to get the best deal they can get. That's what I would try and do. But essentially, you have a cartel of labor in the Portland area. You have a monopoly service provider, TriMet. You have a monopoly on payroll tax revenues. The revenues only flow to the TriMet board. So, you know, when you have a monopoly service institution negotiating with a cartel of labor, it's pretty unlikely you're going to get a low-cost outcome. And on the few occasions when they contract out and they provide you the opportunity to actually see market rate versus in-house rate, the contrast is rather stark. It's rather amusing to see how history is repeating itself here. Contrary to Olivia Clark's assertions, Rose City Transit did not go belly up. They were put out of business by the Portland City Council. They were a private, profitable, dividend-creating company, and they sought in 1968 to get a 5-cent fare increase, and the Portland City Council, which was regulating rates, rejected that, and through eminent domain, put them out of business. Then the legislature created TriMet, allowed the payroll tax to go forward. And after the tax was instituted, it turns out when the dust settled, so much money was raised, it was equivalent to a 25-cent increase that they could have given Rose City Transit, but they wouldn't even give Rose City Transit a nickel increase. And what's interesting is, in one of the official TriMet histories of the time, which I discovered in a box in the TriMet archives, they note that after looking at 7 taxing options of the array authorized by the legislature, TriMet adopted a payroll tax of 0.5% to be effective on January 1, 1970, and hopefully to be reduced to 0.1% or 0.2% as soon as possible. Now, that's underlined in the original of this. This is a TriMet history of itself. Well, what a surprise, of course, the payroll tax did not go down. The tax rate was permanent, and immediately costs to taxpayers went up because, of course, Rose City Transit had no cost to taxpayers before. And this should have been the first clue that running transit as a government monopoly, as a nonprofit, was going to be a very costly affair. There are a number of things that could be tried prior to simply giving more money. One would be to abolish Fareless Square. The original creation of Fareless Square had a lot to do with compliance with the Clean Air Act. Of course, one of the great success stories in the country, a success story that I had some minor part of in a previous career, is the extent to which urban air is so much cleaner now than it was 30, 40 years ago all over the country. I mean, we should have a party to celebrate that. And it's really not going to change due to technological innovation with automobile control technology, industrial control. So to me, the original reason for Fareless Square has pretty much gone away. As a paying customer, I also find it annoying to see the number of street people in Portland who just get on it to go over to Lloyd Center because, gee, it's free, it's something to do. They get in the way of all the actual customers, and it impairs TriMet's ability to get to its long-stated but never-reached goal of 30% fare recovery. So I would suggest that Fairless Square be abolished and that actual consumers of transit be asked to pick up a little more of the freight here instead of just the business community. Second, TriMet has consciously, for the last 20 years, made a choice to use the single most expensive way to move people, which is fixed rail. And there are a few places in the country, like Chicago and New York, where fixed rail makes sense. Portland, a decentralizing region for the last 50 years, is a community where it doesn't make sense. I've attached one little handout on the back that shows costs, operating and fixed costs of rail. You cannot possibly have it pencil out. And regardless of how much money you bring in from the feds, when that's all done, you are the owner of a very expensive fixed rail system, the maintenance of which is all your responsibility, unlike a road-based system where you have millions and millions of trucks and cars who are paying taxes to share. They are mostly paying for the infrastructure. The transit district is, in many respects, a free rider of that. That's why road-based transit makes a lot of sense if you're spending your money. If you're spending someone else's money, then I guess dollars don't matter quite as much. But rail is going to doom TriMet in the long run. Eventually, the feds don't pay as much as you'd like, and I think it's time to pull the plug on that, especially because all the next lines being proposed to Milwaukee, to Clark County, the especially silly Washington County commuter rail, you're running rail into areas that are all suburban. It makes no sense at all. Finally, you might consider... You have to get into a competitive contracting. This labor deal that makes it difficult to contract out, it just creates and rewards the cartelization of labor. You could consider actually splitting the TriMet board off from the agency, since the board itself, I don't think, serves all that big of a function. You go to meetings, they pretty much agree with the staff, life goes on. You could give them something more meaningful to do and make them a sort of an independent transit board and require that for all of the lines in the region, competitive bids be taken. TriMet could be one of many entities submitting a bid to run a Sandy Boulevard route, a Fremont route, a Interstate Avenue route, and the low bidder gets the job. Well, that would instantly change the negotiating structure of TriMet management with its union, and would put consumers much more in the driver's seat, give us more choice, more transit service for the same dollar. All of those things could be considered and experimented with prior to simply increasing the rate, because essentially, in my view, if you do this, you become the enablers for a spending addiction. And years later, when someone else has to deal with a crisis, they're going to wonder why their predecessors didn't take effective action. And I'm sure sometimes right now with bills you're dealing with this session, some of you probably wish your predecessors 10 years ago had done something to make things a little easier for you. So I'm not opposed to transit. I'm a lifelong transit user. I'm not critical of the individuals at TriMet. They're all doing things that are extremely rational to them from their institutional standpoint. This is an institutional problem. This is not a personal problem. And I think you need to create different types of institutions. And simply expanding the tax rate, to me, just has us doing the same old thing, which I don't think it is going to work too well in the future. So thank you for your patience and for not cutting me off after 3 minutes, which happens so often in front of the Portland City Council. I appreciate it. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Thank you for your testimony. Any questions?
Yes, I would agree. We could contest social philosophy here. We could also talk about your memory of what happened with Rose City Transit versus my memory. That was fairly close to it at the time. But the real question is, my sense is that you're suggesting there's a kind of left-wing monopolistic conspiracy here to sort of defraud either the taxpayers or the business community. And I wonder if you'd like to comment on why Nike and Fred Meyer and U.S. Bank and those other left-wing organizations like that are so willing to support this socialistic monopolistic enterprise that you paint as.
For a couple of comments, I don't have a memory of Rose City Transit because I wasn't here at the time. All of my information is from research in the TriMet files. There is no conspiracy theory. What is happening is right out in the public. It's there. Just people are making conscious decisions. TriMet is a monopoly. They do have exclusive use of the payroll tax money. If you wanted to give people choice, you could voucherize it, like our food stamp program
but
is.
You're
choosing not to. So that's not
my
a conspiracy.
The question is, why does the business community
I can't speak
support?
For them.
Oh, okay. You're not speaking for the business community then?
No. I'm speaking for my organization. We're a free market think tank, frankly. So, many business organizations like cartels and monopolies, and they like you to help create them.
Find me follow, sir? So you'd automatically be against this because it's a government enterprise rather than a free enterprise, is that?
I'm opposed to the premise that transit has to be heavily subsidized by other parties. I think consumers of transit, of which I'm one, can and should bear a bigger part of the cost. And I think even if it is run as a government entity, you can inject competition and choice into that system. You could leave TriMet as it is, but you could create more incentives for them to control cost. And if you, for instance, the city of Indianapolis put 30, 40, at least probably 50 city services up for competition. And in many cases, the in-house agency got the winning bid. But having to bid for it had a very beneficial effect on the way they did business because they suddenly had to look at cost for the first time in a serious way. So I'm not saying that you have to privatize the transit industry.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Gilman.
You propose eliminating the free zone. I wonder if just convenience for ridership doesn't make a little sense in a certain section of the city, just irregardless of clean air.
Well, you're right. It is more convenient. But my observation as someone who's hopped on and off buses in the Fairless Square hundreds and hundreds of times is frequently I'm only going six blocks, eight blocks, bus comes along, sure, it's free, I'll hop on. Well, if you have thousands of people doing that, it increases the dwell time. It just slows everything down. And what are you accomplishing? You're sort of artificially inflating ridership levels. You're confusing. If you're an actual business owner, it's sort of confusing. What is the real market demand for your product? If it's free, sure, there's lots of demand, but you have to pay the bills. So it confuses the real demand. It degrades service for actual paying customers. It makes it more difficult to get through, which is one of the very frustrating parts as a transit rider, is the amount of time you have to actually spend in downtown Portland before you can kind of get on with your trip. And I don't think... this assertion that it's taking a lot of people out of cars, I guess, I don't buy that. I think it's people who are already, they're just pedestrians, and they hop on a bus or MAX, and they go seven or eight blocks. Why? Well, because they can, that's why. I go to Portland State for seminars all the time from my office, and I hop on it. I don't need to do that. It's a nice day. I could just walk. I could actually pay. I could do something else. So I just, it's a nice thing. It's not necessary.
We have some other people who want to testify on this, so I'm going to move ahead, committee. Thank you for your testimony.
Thank you, sir.
Could I have Jeff Carlson, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jeff Carlson. I represent Ironworkers Local 29. I'm here today in support of Senate Bill 549. For obvious reasons, the jobs it'll create, I understand that the long-range forecast for this bill will fund the light rail continuation on 205 up to Milwaukee, I believe. That'll create thousands of jobs. It doesn't do anything for the short-term fix that, with the 30% unemployment that we're creating that I experience with Local 29 right now. One thing I'd like to mention, though, is beyond the jobs, it's livability. I've been an iron worker for 30 years, and I've worked all over the country. I worked in New York City, San Francisco Bay Area, Seattle, Washington, and lots of other places. I've had the opportunity to use mass transit, rail transit in New York. I used to I lived on 28th Street. I'd walk to Grand Central and jump on the train to go to Bedford Hills, New York, and then and all five boroughs. I was there for an extended period of time. And I worked in Seattle area, and I got to tell you, Seattle is a nightmare. I worked in Everett for a year and a half on the Boeing expansion when they built the 777 hangar, and I frequented downtown Seattle and worked in that area too. And you know, you have Lake Washington on one side, you have Puget Sound on the other side, and a very narrow strip of land where Seattle sits. The founding fathers didn't have the vision to create mass transit in that area. It doesn't matter what time of the day or night you're in Seattle. I don't know if you've been there, but it's just a parking lot. The gentleman before me mentioned, build more roads, which I don't have a problem with that. And he talked about millions of cars. The millions of cars doing 0 miles an hour does not fix the problem. It just creates another nightmare. Anyway, I'm just here to urge your support of the bill. Thanks.
Thank you, Jeff. Any questions? Don't see any. Thank you, Jeff. Could I have, Fred, would you come back up again for a minute? I got a question. Is your friend benefit 65% of your cost of your salaries?
Mr. President, or Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, let me maybe just say a couple of quick things, maybe, and then get kind of the specifics, and because I think we all know numbers can be used in different ways. You all have been wrestling a lot with the retirement system, the PERS system, because that's one of the points that John Charles makes. By the way, John is somebody who I've worked with on those clean air issues, and I think we had some real successes then together. But we disagree on this issue on the pension. First off, is that the TriMet is not a part of the PERS system. One of the issues that you have debated very hard is, and looked at very much, is what is that replacement of final average salary? What's that percent, and how does it affect? Our pension plan is one that pays, on average, 35% of replacement salary. 35%. And we went through and found the longest serving, because ours is a defined benefit plan, a 40-year employee, road ops individual, they would be receiving the maximum replacement salary, that is at 48%. Now, we, as everybody else, when the stock market's been down, we have a provision of our contract that says we must replace whatever lost earnings there are over a 20-year amortization schedule. That is one of the reasons why our pension costs have gone up over the last several years, because we are required to be able to have a fully funded, at least over time, a fully funded pension plan. And that is a part of that. On the healthcare side, I would say that likewise, we've all seen major increases in healthcare. Prescription drugs are one of the major issues. We have a average workforce that's slightly older than the average workforce. We're at 46 years old, and as a result, prescription drugs are a very real part of that. We think that the long-term solution of that is to be able to get more preventative healthcare programs in place that allow us to lower some of those demands on that prescription drug side. We have instituted a defined contribution plan for management and staff employees. Other issues, of course, are subject to collective bargaining. But I'd be happy to answer any specific questions. The one that you referenced, that is not a number that's not how we relate numbers. I'd want to be able to take a look at a bit more behind John's numbers to be able to understand what it is. But my guess is he's looking at total budget rather than what is the way I think you have to look at it is in cost of operating on a regular route basis.
Thank you. Any other questions? Looks like they're it. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, members.
I'm going to close the public hearing and move on down to and open the work session on Senate Bill 83A. I'm jumping around all over the board here. Was there any additional testimony?
We did.
Okay. Was there anyone here that wanted to testify on 83A?
ready to send it on its way. Huh? The chair would move the Senate Bill 83. Oh, we have an amendment?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, explain.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You saw the 83-A3 amendment on May 2nd, but it was not adopted or added into the bill. This is the bill that Representative Greenlick had. This was an amendment proposed by the Road User Fee Task Force and the Department of Transportation, saying that they may not develop technology that identifies precise time and course of the travel of any individual. The change on line four was, instead of in the previous amendment, I can't remember what the word was, facilitate, the committee chose the word allows, and that was redrafted as A3. So you've seen these amendments. Does everyone have a copy? Mm-hmm. Okay. So that was, but you've seen them but haven't adopted them.
Do you need a motion?
Need a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move adoption of the A3 amendment to Senate Bill 83.
Representative Dingfelder moves the adoption of the A3 amendments to Senate Bill 83. Is there any objection? Seeing none, they are adopted. And this bill has a referral to Ways and Means, and so I need a motion.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 83 as adopted to Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Dingfelder moves Senate Bill 83 as amended to the Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion?
Is it Ways and Means or Revenue?
Ways and Means, yes. Seeing no discussion, Ryan, you call the vote.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Beyer.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Greenlick.
Aye.
Representative Mabry.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carried. I guess we'll open a work session on House Bill 2217, and we have some amendments. Janice, get us up to speed where we're at here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2217 has had two hearings. This is the bill that would make Oregon statutes on truck safety in compliance with federal law. It applies the farm vehicle exemption from commercial safety inspections only to vehicles in intrastate commerce. So the state would become eligible to inspect farm vehicles if they are in interstate commerce under the measure. There's a couple of additional changes that have been non-controversial about seatbelt use and about the vehicles that may or have to stop at crossings. Since the last meeting, the Department of Transportation was notified at the end of April that the waiver requested by them earlier or last year by the federal government to waive this particular requirement about truck inspections was not granted, and so that's the result of that waiver request. And there's been quite a bit of work on that by our congressional delegation to get that waiver, but it was denied.
John, how much was the federal funding? Just remind me on this.
$4.8 million. Biennium.
At your place today, you're probably seeing it for the first time, the House Bill 2217-2 amendments, and there may be someone from the department that you want to hear from to explain these, but they say the criteria that will be used and the goal of the annual commercial motor vehicle safety plan developed by the department.
This amendment is essentially what the department practices now and puts it into statute what they do in practice. Could I have Greg and...
Could I ask Janet a question?
Certainly.
On this intrastate commerce, if the exemption is, in fact, to intrastate commerce, does that continue to put the federal subsidy in question?
Mr. Chair and Representative Green, the intrastate commerce, trucks carrying goods in intrastate commerce has not been in question, and it will remain exempt.
So this bill would not put, it would require us to follow the traffic safe, the inspection, the safety inspections for trucks carrying goods in interstate commerce. I understand that might be just taking it from the farm to the terminal.
Right.
This would not put that at risk. Is that right?
It would for interstate at risk. I'm not sure what you mean by that.
No, I mean this does. The effect of this bill would not put our federal highway safety funds in jeopardy. Is that correct?
Right. Greg, please. Good morning, Greg.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I am Greg Delpani, Administrator for the Motor Carrier Transportation Division of ODOT. And the department has no difficulty whatsoever with the amendments as written, as in fact they do, in fact, as the chair observed, mirror our current practice. We already prepare a commercial vehicle safety plan. The commercial vehicle safety plan sets out our proposed actions with regard to the administration of the safety program. This document is assembled based on objective safety data, and we use performance measurement to gauge our success. So we are simply embodying in statute what is, in essence, a current practice of the department.
And, Greg, over the last several weeks, particularly over the last 2 days, I've seen a great deal more of this bill than I really cared to ever see here. But the and out of those discussions, and the practice with the department would be that, in my understanding, that the grant dollars would go to the state police, and through that we'd have a uniform enactment of the or the work that's done in these truck inspections would be uniform over the state through the state police. Is that my understanding, or is that right?
Mr. Chairman, you're correct that the department has the wherewithal to direct the investment of these federal grant resources, and the department is willing to accept the legislative direction as to how that is best accomplished.
Thank you. Is there any other questions? Great. Don't see any. Thank you. Is there anyone else that wants to testify? Jean. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Jean Underhill Wilkinson, representing the Oregon Farm Bureau Federation. Well, this statutory exemption has been what farmers consider to be a protection that they've had over the last 25 years. And I understand the dynamics of the situation. I understand that the state is badly in need of any funding source that they can get their hands on, and I completely understand that. There are a few, there's no doubt in my mind that this will cost some farmers some money. There's some things in the federal regulations that we'll need to work out and educate the farming community about, and I hope, and I'm sure that ODOT is willing to do that. Greg Delpani has put a lot of resources into this issue so far, and I'm sure he'll continue doing that to provide that education. There are a few things in the federal regulations, such as brake warning systems and additional record keeping and things that are practices that some farmers probably don't do that will need to be added definitely before next harvest season. So this this bill will be considered by the farming community to be something that takes a privilege away from them that they've had over the last 25 years. The Oregon Farm Bureau will continue to object to the bill on behalf of the members because that is what our board has guided us to do. But I appreciate all the time and effort that the committee members and the chair has put into this issue, and we'll just accept it and see how we can make it work in the farming community. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane. Is there any questions?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
Hi, good morning. You think eventually we'll get there to help the farmers live with this bill, or what's your sense?
Well, Mr. Chair, Representative Zahner, we'll have to. The potential consequence, I understand that ODOT may not be doing a lot of inspections of farm trucks because the accident statistics for farm trucks is very low. We account for less than 1% of the accidents in the state. That poses the question for the farming community why this is needed, of course. Still, there is a potential that these trucks will be inspected at the time of harvest, and if they aren't in compliance with the federal regulations upon that inspection, they could be taken off the road. I think that's a liability that farmers can't risk, and the farm trucks will need to be equipped or dealt with so that they are in full compliance. So we'll need to take on that responsibility to make sure that that gets done.
Representative Byer.
Thank you. As we're the only state now that doesn't do this, have you been in contact with other states to determine whether there are pretty severe consequences to them? I think as the only exception, I can't imagine that the other states' farm income has suffered greatly on the issue. So if you have any other information, I'd appreciate it.
Mr. Chair, Representative Byer, I don't have any more information than that. I understand that through in the mid-90s, there were multiple states that were out of compliance that have been forced into compliance. I don't think it was just farm trucks. It was various issues. And I'm sure that those states had to deal with it. It doesn't mean that it didn't cost their farming communities money and resources. I'm sure they suffered through it. It's just an additional cost for these small business people who don't receive a lot of profits from farming because the costs of farming are so high and the prices for commodities are so low. That margin is there's no profit margin or a negative margin. And this is just an additional cost that that people will have to absorb. It's not easy for some of these small businesses.
Any other questions, Gene? Gene, I want to thank you, I can assure you that your industry and your association is well represented, that you're a tough negotiator, I think.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Try to get a raise, is that what you're saying?
Greg, can I ask you one more time to come up and I could you, for the record, just define a little bit about the time frame and implementing this change that will take place for the inspections? And my understanding is it'll probably be well into the fall or close to into the fall before they would be. Are those assumptions right?
Mr. Chairman, yes, you're correct. The bill has an emergency clause. It's effective upon passage. However, to implement this bill will require some time for me to, number one, keep my commitment to the Farm Bureau, that I will travel the state and attend meetings of their members and to provide whatever instruction and training is necessary to assist them in meeting these regulations. Also time to implement with regard to adequately instructing my staff as to how to implement and how to make use of these statutory revisions in the manner that we've discussed previously and the commitments that I've made, and in some necessary policy and rule changes. So I would imagine that the implementation is going to extend well past this year's harvest season.
Thank you, Greg. Representative,
just to follow up again, I mentioned it earlier, but I had the pleasure of having Greg come out to a bunch of St. Paul farmers when they had a concern. And Greg, if you handle the rest of the state the way you handle it out there, I'm sure all our problems will be solved. You're to be commended. You spent a lot of time with them, but then they had a lot of concerns, but you were able to handle them. And sometimes with farmers, that's not easy to do.
Well, Mr. Chairman, Representative Zahner, I appreciate the compliment, but as I recall, I had a good deal of assistance from you, so I thank you for that as well.
Well, you guys team up. It's a
thank you, Greg. Appreciate that. Committee, the chair would move the adoption of the -2 amendments. Is there any more discussion? Is there any objection? They are adopted. Need a motion then on the amended bill.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2217 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Beyer moves House Bill 2217 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Representative Mabry.
I certainly will support the motion. I don't think the Farm Bureau or anyone else is quite ready to put $5 million on the table as a substitute for the loss of revenue, and I don't fault them for that. I find it, however, unreasonable to think that driving the 9 miles from a wheat farm in Wasco to a grain elevator in Biggs Junction is any different than driving the 9 miles from a wheat field to a feedlot is any different, one the other, but one's interstate commerce because it'll be shipped out further and the other is not. That makes no sense to me. My logic doesn't buy into that, unless, of course, you consider the fact that when you ship the beef, that has made it interstate commerce, and that's a whole nother issue. It also makes no sense to me that a farm vehicle being inspected and passing once some items have been corrected, they get a sticker on their windshield that allows them, unless there's some erratic behavior, exempt from further inspections for a period of 3 months. It makes no sense to me why the federal government couldn't recognize the fact that they have an inspection pre-harvest that does exactly the same thing, because the fact is a wheat truck pulling into a wheat field could knock some brake lines loose or some electrical systems loose or some such thing right after an inspection and still be exempted from that safety inspection, where a pre-safety inspection could accomplish the same thing or not be any worse, and yet the federal government doesn't recognize that. I find those all silly reasons and reasons why the farm community is up in arms about this bill. Having said all that, it's our federal government. We've got to comply with the rules, and I will support the bill. But I also support the position of the Farm Bureau. They're right.
Representative Gilman.
Mr. Chair.
Could I get on my screen?
Get on your screen and get out of here.
And put your helmet on.
In this body, we try to resolve problems and make life better. I don't think this bill does meets either of those tests. 1%, less than 1% accident rate, there isn't a problem with farm vehicles. And for that reason, I'm going to be a no vote on this bill.
Thank you, Representative. Any other comment? Well, Representative Beyer.
Thank you. And I tend to agree with you that the farm vehicles really do constitute such a small number that it's unfortunate that we're put in this position, but I really hate to lose the money that would provide other safety inspections that could help on the roads. So, and I know that at this point in time, and hopefully with this amendment, it will continue regardless of whether we lose Greg or not, that we're going to still target those problems on major problems on the road. We're not going to be targeting that 1%. And with that confidence, I do definitely support this bill.
Thank you, Representative. Any other comments? I would just echo the comments that have already been made. In light of the way the department approaches the inspections, and it's based upon the safety records and the performance in the farming industry. So I truly believe that there would probably be very little difference to the farming industry. Having said that, I've had several discussions with Greg about pre-inspections of seasonal vehicles that are used just seasonally, like the farm industry does. There's other industries that do that, and Greg's explained to me a number of times why they can't accomplish that. They have 90 some inspectors to inspect over 300,000 trucks throughout the state, and it'd be almost physically impossible for them to accomplish that. But having said that, I've made a commitment to the farm community and probably to the other seasonal fleets that I will still look at and work towards, and hopefully with the department, way of accomplishing that, and see if we can in the future do some pre-season inspections of vehicles to leave some of that trouble that these inspections do cause during the season.
I guess I would like to make a comment, Mr. Chair.
Certainly.
I think it's really urgent that we not screw up the harvest time. So I don't think anybody's really worried about that. But I'd like to just comment just briefly to Representative Mabry's comment, which I think is important. I've been trying to work pretty hard because of the nature of my district to get involved in this rural-urban divide thing and to better understand the very important industry we have in this state in the agriculture industry. And one of the things that I found most startling is that the sense of how Oregon members of the agricultural community particularly believe that they're really not very much in local markets anymore. The community prides itself not only on the intrastate nature of its industry, but in fact on the global nature of its industry. And Oregon really is moving forward to be a part of the global agricultural trade. So the sense is they are really big, huge parts of our agricultural industry in this state really is in both interstate and international commerce. Now, that doesn't mean we ought to do silly things, and I'm not arguing for that, but the notion that the nature of our agricultural industry for its strength is the international and interstate nature of it, and that's, I think, very important, and I've come to really appreciate that piece of the industry. Now, I don't know why I said that.
But sounds good. Thank you, Representative. Any other? Ryan, will you call the roll, please?
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Representative Beyer.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
No.
Representative Greenlight.
Aye.
Representative Mabry.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries. Do I have a volunteer to carry it on the floor?
I will.
Representative Beyer will be the carrier on the floor.
Responsibility of leadership.
Open the public hearing and work session on Senate Bill 508. Janet, can you...
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 508 is a bill that came from the Senate Transportation Committee, and it creates changes to our special registration license plate program. It would limit the legislature to authorizing no more than three kinds of specialty background plates at any one time. Also require you to eliminate a current specialty background plate if you're going to authorize a new one during a legislative session. Eliminates special group plates for motorhomes and travel trailers. They have been in stock and have been used, but not very to any great extent. Requires a $10,000 application fee for a new group plate. These are not the background plates. These are the group plates that have wording on the side. That amount would be refunded if the Department of Transportation sells 1,000 sets of plates in the first year. And it also requires ODOT to cease production of a group plate if less than 500 are sold or renewed each year. So that's higher than the current level of, I'm not sure. Kelly's here to explain. There are A2 amendments that take care of some of the technical aspects. We've done a little bit of hand engrossing of the A2 amendments. These things should have been at your place the last meeting, so I hope you have everything. If you don't, we have extra copies to show where the deletions and insertions go. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Janet. Kelly, please. I know this makes our world better, so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I'm Kelly Taylor at the Department of Transportation. You probably remember when you had a hearing on different plate bills. There's about, somewhere between 8 and 10 or maybe more floating around in the building. And that it's happening more and more each session. And you all expressed an interest to make some changes. And the Senate also heard some plate bills and expressed an interest to make some changes. And Senator Metzger, the chair of Senate Transportation and Economic Development Committee, asked me to check out what some of the other states were doing to try to get their arms around it and corral it a little bit. So we did do some checking. I won't say we called all 50 states. We did some checking to see what we could find out there. And it was pretty interesting. A lot of the states are doing or have done exactly what this bill would do, and in some even bigger fashions. States are requiring a higher and higher number to be issued in order to stay current. They are limiting plates. They are requiring the special interest groups to put up, in essence, earnest money. I saw some legislation in Massachusetts requiring $100,000 to be put up by a group. Florida routinely requires, I think, around $16,000 to be put up, and only part of that can be returned after the first year. They require, in one state I saw, like 1,200 plates or something like that had to be issued, I think, in the first year and every year after. What this bill does is it says on the specialty plates with the special backgrounds, three at a time. And if you want a new one, pick one to discontinue, which is what you did in 97. You discontinued Oregon Trail and started the salmon. So there's some precedence there. It also says on the groups, it doesn't prohibit anybody from having a group plate as long as they match it, but just that they put up some earnest money. And as Senator Metzger described it, is it shows that the group has some organized marketing plan and some organization around it rather than just saying, hi, this would be great, make us a new plate, and then they don't sell. They were very dismayed to see the numbers that I had handed out to you all with how few of plates had been sold or kept going. So this doesn't kick anybody out that's already got a plate unless they just don't sell the right amount or renew the right amount. And it picked $10,000 as the earnest money amount, and that would be refunded in full if they sold 1,000 sets in the first year, which the $10,000 limit is much, much lower than some of the states I found. The 1,000 for first year sale was lower than what I found. The 500 a year to be renewed or issued to keep it going was lower than what I had found in some states, higher than others. In Washington, they simply leave it to the Department of Licensing to determine when a plate should be discontinued. So, I mean, it was as broad as that and as high as $100,000. So this seemed to be a good step in the direction that you all were interested in taking. And it passed, I think, with only two no votes in the Senate. So it was unanimous out of committee. And with that, Mr. Chair, I end my comments.
Thank you, Kelly. And the Dash 2 amendments?
Oh, excuse me, Mr. Chair. Yes, the Dash 2 amendments, once we looked at the bill, we realized that there was some corrections that needed to be done. There was some redundant language throughout the bill. The things you see being taken out, for example, on page 1, lines 22 through 25, that language was inserted throughout the bill. And there's actually another statute on record that you already have done that says you can transfer a plate as long as it's a current issue. In other words, as long as it's current. And after that, to transfer it, it must be considered, you must make it a custom plate. It's to help weed them out after time. So there was no need to keep putting that language over and over in this bill because there's a whole other statute that you passed many years ago to deal with this. And then we just wanted to, I worked with Ledge Council to refine better special registration plate because the current language swept in a whole bunch of plates to be considered for extinction that really weren't meant to be, like the ham operator plate, the antique special vehicle plate, the elected official plate. So this is a better definition that's coming in the Dash 2s.
Yeah, thank you. Is there any questions, Kelly?
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Kelly, I'm a little confused.
Mm-hmm.
There were two kinds of special plates. There were those kind that weren't very complex to do, that they were all the same, and you just...
Those are the group plates, right.
They're not included in this amendment.
Yes, they are. They're, okay. Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlick, the special background plates are what you see at the very beginning of the bill called special registration plates, where it limits them to three at a time. The others that are on the tree plate that are nonprofit, veteran, and higher ed, those are called group plates, and those are the ones that the group would put up a $10,000 earnest fee that they could then get back after 1 year if they sold 1,000 sets. So yes, we're dealing with both plates in here, but in slightly different ways. In one, with the special background plates like Crater Lake Salmon, you're putting a limit on them. With the group plates, you're not putting a limit on how many group plates can exist, but you're simply raising the bar on what they do to qualify.
If I may follow?
Follow.
And we have like seven now of the...
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlick, there are over 30... There are 30 group plates.
I don't mean the group plates.
There are... the tree plate and three specialty plates. We have a few of the Oregon Trail camper plates left. So you're at the maximum right now.
We are at the maximum.
You are at the maximum
right now.
That
includes the cultural trust?
Mr. Chair and Representative Greenlick, that's correct. That was the last one started.
So if there's going to be another one...
You need to pick one to discontinue.
Get rid of one of those.
Yes, under this bill.
Janet, you were going
on. I just want to point out to members, in case anyone's wondering, well, what if next session they just change this? They would be this. You can't bind a future legislature in any way because this is a statutory change, and obviously you're not going to put this in the Constitution. But just if anyone's wondering, this is only the intent and the statute. This legislative
a session. Future legislature could change it. Yes.
Any other questions, Kelly? Don't see any. Committee, I'd take a motion to adopt the dash 2 amendment.
I would so move.
Representative Mabry moves we adopt the dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 508. Is there any objection or any discussion? Any objection? Adopted.
I would move Senate Bill 508 as amended to the House floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Mabry moves Senate Bill 508 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Good bill.
good bill should pass.
That's right. Any more discussion? Ryan, call the roll, please.
Representative Byer.
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder.
Aye.
Representative Gilman.
Aye.
Representative Greenlake.
Aye.
Representative Mabry.
Aye.
Representative Zahner.
Aye.
Chair Brown.
Aye. Motion carries.
Consent.
Consent calendar.
C.
Representative Dingfelder moves that Senate Bill 508, as amended, be placed on the consent calendar. Any objection? Seeing none, ordered. And committee, I'm going to carry the Senate Bill 180 over to our next meeting. And have we got everything on there, Janet? Okay, we got one more meeting, regular meeting. It's our intent right now that we will, because of drafting, we don't have a transportation bill printed out yet, and so we will start hearings on that next week. And to give us a little room to get things to look at the bill before we start the hearings, I'll try to schedule it for Wednesday now with speaker's approval of next week. Representative,
do you have a work session at 596?
596.
Is that
right?
The TriMet one?
Oh, yeah, TriMet.
Not today. That'll come back up on the agenda Friday.
First one we heard about the new vehicle.
Yeah, 549.
Yeah.
Oh, 549.
And they can all go to work now, right?
Well, so they can ride the train. is there anything else for the Senator Dukes? How are you this morning? I think we sent your bill on the way, didn't we?
Which one was hers?
The one with the moving the vehicles off the...
Oh, yeah, that's been moved
early on.
We shoved it down the road.
Yeah.
We are adjourned.